This is a recording from the Kluge Rue Collection at the University of Virginia. On February 13, 2008, the collection sponsored the first John W. and Maria T. Kluge Distinguished Lecture in Arts and Humanities, featuring Professor Terry E. Smith of the University of Pittsburgh. The lecture was introduced by Collection Director Margot Smith, who announced the date's historical significance.
Yesterday, Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd issued a formal apology to Australia's Indigenous people, in particular the Stolen Generations and their families, for past mistreatment. Rudd announced, "We apologize for the laws and policies of successive parliaments and governments that have inflicted profound grief, suffering, and loss on these our fellow Australians. We apologize especially for the removal of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children from their families, their communities, and their country. For the pain, suffering, and hurt of these stolen generations, their descendants, and for their families left behind, we say sorry. To the mothers and the fathers, the brothers and the sisters, for the breaking up of families and communities, we say sorry. And for the indignity and degradation thus inflicted on a proud people and a proud culture, we say sorry. We, the Parliament of Australia, respectfully request that this apology be received in the spirit in which it is offered as part of the healing of the nation." That's just a part of the announcement that he made. And this announcement follows Australia's recent change in leadership from the Liberal Party under John Howard to the Labor Party. It gives one pause that it has taken so long to get to this point, and it gives one hope that more progressive changes are underway. Welcome to the John W. and Maria T. Kluge Distinguished Lecture in Arts and Humanities. This is the inaugural lecture of what will be an annual event intended to raise awareness about the Kluge Rue Collection at the university and in the community. By focusing on the arts and humanities, we plan to draw audiences from across various disciplines at the university. This lecture is named for John and Tissy Kluge, who are among the University of Virginia's most generous benefactors. Their donation of the Kluge Rue Aboriginal Art Collection in 1997 has enriched the cultural landscape for UVA students and faculty and for members of the community. The Kluge Rue Collection is considered to be the best collection of Australian Aboriginal art outside Australia and is the only museum dedicated to Australian Aboriginal art in the Americas. Many people have contributed to this event and the opening of the satellite exhibit, Our Way, Contemporary Aboriginal Art from Lockhart River in Newcomb Hall Art Gallery following the lecture. I'd like to thank Jennifer Gallagher, the Art Gallery Program Advisor, for helping organize the space, and the students who assisted us with the installation, Simon Adiv, Ashley LeFou, Allison Turner, and Sophia Ahmad. I'd also like to thank the University of Queensland for organizing and sponsoring the Our Way exhibit, and curator Sally Butler, who developed the exhibit and made it possible for us to show the work in this venue. Special thanks are also due President John Castine, who provided special funding for both the exhibit and the lecture. Before we begin, I'd like to introduce our special guests tonight, Terry Yumbel and his wife Clelly from Wigram Island in Arnhem Land. Where are they? Over here. Terry is the leader. Terry is the leader of the Waramari group, an artist and sculptor whose art represents the enduring, culturally significant stories of his people. He comes from a long line of artists, some of whom we were able to identify this morning in Ed Brew's archives at the Kluge Rue Collection. Terry will present a slideshow and talk about his art and culture on Friday night at 7 p.m. at the Kluge Rue Collection, and we are taking reservations for that talk. I'd also like to introduce Leslie Shorp. Where's Leslie? Over here. A former Kluge Rue intern and 2001 graduate of UVA's College of Arts and Sciences, who's with us this week. Leslie, who works at the Metropolitan Museum of Art and has been there for 3 years, just completed a master's degree in museum anthropology from Columbia University. She conducted field research with artists at Lockhart River this summer. And on Friday at 4 p.m., Leslie will speak on Getting Your Foot in the Door, From the Lawn to Lockhart River and a Career in the Arts, One UVA Alum's Experience. That's in Newcomb Hall Art Gallery. She has an abiding interest in Aboriginal art that began with a semester in Australia and grew through her time at Kluge Rue. And we're really proud of Leslie and encouraging to her in her career. Our speaker this evening is Terry Smith, the Andrew W. Mellon Professor of Contemporary Art History and Theory in the Department of the History of Art and Architecture at the University of Pittsburgh. He is also a visiting professor in the Faculty of Architecture, University of Sydney. During 2001 and 2002, he was a Getty Scholar at the Getty Institute in Los Angeles, Getty Research Institute in Los Angeles. And this year, he's the GlaxoSmithKline Senior Fellow at the National Humanities Research Center in Raleigh-Durham. From 1994 to 2001, he was Power Professor of Contemporary Art and Director of the Power Institute, Foundation for Art and Visual Culture, University of Sydney. He's the author of a number of books, notably Making the Modern, Industry, Art, and Design in America, Transformations in Australian Art, Volume 1, The 19th Century Landscape, Colony, and Nation, and Volume 2, The 20th Century Modernism and Aboriginality, and The Architecture of Aftermath. A Foundation Board Member of the Museum of Contemporary Art Sydney, he is currently a board member of the Andy Warhol Museum, Pittsburgh. And I asked around who might be the person to give this lecture, the first in this series of distinguished lectures. And Fred Myers, who is a friend of the collection and a friend of mine, is the one who suggested Terry Smith. He said, he's very distinguished. But with that resume, I can't think of anybody else who would be better suited to talk to us today about contemporary art with his extensive knowledge on that topic and also about Aboriginal art. So I ask you to help me welcome Terry Smith with What is Contemporary About Aboriginal Art?
I think being distinguished goes with the hair colour, I'm afraid, which makes a number of people here distinguished. I acknowledge the traditional owners of this land, the Moakan peoples. I acknowledge Terry Nimblewall from Elko Island and his wife who joined us today. I acknowledge my friend and art historical colleague Roger Stein, recently retired from a very distinguished career as an historian of American art at this university, and one of the people who welcomed me when I first came to do research and to try and do some teaching in this country over 20 years ago. So thank Roger for being here. It's an honour. I also thank, of course, Margot Smith for organising this lecture and Leslie for help with the PowerPoint, which you're about to see in a moment. So let's have that as a framework. It's an honour to be invited to give this lecture, especially when I do so in the context of a distinguished collection of the art of the Aboriginal peoples of Australia, such a distinguished collection as the one, the Klugiroo collection. The Aboriginal people of Australia that is indeed my home country. And today is one of the days in which one can be very proud of saying that, because today is the day the Australian government, as you heard, at very long last, has issued a formal apology to the Aboriginal people for the wrongs inflicted upon them since settlement. I read it online this morning. It brought tears to my eyes. It's something many of us have waited for a very long time. Okay, now I'll set out the argument of today's lecture in a summary form as a kind of introduction, and then I'll go and show you and discuss in detail a number of works by a range of contemporary Aboriginal artists that I hope will show you that I'm offering what I hope to be a valid and challenging interpretation of what is contemporary about them. So the question before us, I think, is what is contemporary about Australian Aboriginal art? I'll phrase it in this way to start with. In what sense might an art based on imagery and procedures perhaps 40,000 years old be properly regarded as contemporary? It seems a contradiction. It seems an impossibility on the face of it. And to really dramatise the scope of this question, let me show you this page. It's from David Christian, who is an Australian historian. He's what's called a big history writer. It's his book, This Fleeting World, A Short History of Humanity, as you see, published just a few months ago, published particularly as a handbook for teachers of big history, which is becoming an important subject in secondary schools in the United States and elsewhere. So he's trying on this sheet here to set out the entire history of humans on the Earth in terms of their major eras and their subordinate eras. You can see where in this one down here, this tiny little era down the bottom, contemporary. And I'll come back to that in a minute. If we were to put the question I just put to you in big history terms, it would go something like this. How can we regard as contemporary the art of essentially a foraging peoples whose way of life has been displaced for centuries and whose near extinction by the forces of ever-accelerating populations, productivity and consumption of the world's resources and the concentration of these energies in urban centres is one of the defining features of the modern world? Because if you go through his description of the modern world, societies based mainly on modern industrial technologies, and look at societies based mainly on foraging life ways, which were meant to have finished 10,000 BP before the present, 10,000 years ago, they're meant to have basically finished. Some of them, if you read his chapter, he says have survived, but they're just about gone, and the driving force of history goes through bang like that through the modern. Now in that context, the question of how can Aboriginal art produced clearly with reference back to values that were formed during this era here, how can that kind of art be regarded as contemporary? So this is a very dramatic and hugely large way of putting the question. Now, within art discourse, the way in which art world people like me talk to each other, we usually answer this question much more narrowly. And we give two common answers. We say, for example, that the output of certain Aboriginal artists from remote communities since 1970 has been widely heralded as the most accomplished art produced in Australia since then and is amongst the best abstract painting being done anywhere. It achieves attention in the market as a specific category, one that has been sustained now for over 30 years. So we see scenes like this, very common. These young women lined up to bid on Rover Thomas painting in 2002. So if it's a category in the contemporary art market, if this is abstract painting, if any of these generalizations work, well, in that sense, it's contemporary. Second sort of answer, and I'll show you images that relate to this a bit later. The art of urban-based artists, such as Gordon Bennett, is prominent amongst those that which deals powerfully with the contradictions of contemporary life. Or, for example, Tracy Moffat's allegories of our thoroughly mediated condition are highly esteemed in international art circles. They certainly are. The question about these judgments, though, is that they might assimilate Aboriginal artists to incompatible Western aesthetic criteria. Do they do that? They certainly accept that the Euro-American art world and its institutions define what it is to be contemporary. If Aboriginal art fits into these criteria, then it's contemporary, but if not, it's not. And this is the point that Richard Bell makes, the Murray artist from Queensland, lives in Brisbane now. Richard Bell makes this point. Aboriginal art, he says, it's a white thing. Now, to me, when you put the debate in these terms, that's to say, strictly within the art world, I think it has to be one thing or another. You're really not going to be able to answer the question in any interesting or intelligent way. I'll argue instead, and this is in the summary of the notes about this lecture, I'll argue that a quite other and quite specific kind of modernisation of traditional painting practices and sculptural practices, making practices, marking practices, has been undertaken by certain Australian Aboriginal artists, one that's entailed a strenuous and far-reaching renovation of the arts and crafts, quote-unquote, that they had been previously generated in missionary, tourist and educative exchanges with their colonisers. But the important point here is that this is done for purposes larger than and prior to art itself. The main goal of Aboriginal art has not been to enter into an imagined universal art historical canon, specifically the phases known as modern, postmodern, or contemporary. Rather, this art is the product of necessity and of a reach, I believe the most successful to date, towards surviving the conditions of colonisation and finding a sustainable reconciliation with the colonising other. That's really what it's about at its core, I think. Therefore, it's a contemporary creation of value. It places simultaneously one pre-ancient temporality against another modern temporality, while at the same time recognising differential flows occurring within both of them and between them. It's about being in time, living with different kinds of time, living with times that are spiritual times that are secular times. It's about living in and between these kinds of times. And in that sense, because it's about the multiplicity of ways of being in time, it's a contemporary art practice. That's the nutshell of my argument. Let me try and convince you of it. First, let me do so by showing you what I do in my contemporary art courses, which do include lectures on contemporary Aboriginal art, as indeed I try and cover the contemporary art of the entire world in my courses at Pittsburgh. I believe it's the first place that's attempting to do that. It takes us a year, but we're doing it. Contemporary. I ask the students first to just consider the concept of the contemporary, not just take it as something, you know, whatever's happening. Go back to its original meanings. It means, first off, belonging to the same time or period. It's a very important thing to belong to your time or period. Not everyone does. Not everyone feels that they do. It's a complex and profound thing to belong to your time. It's a strong sense of being with time. That's available with the term contemporary. Or you could have existed or lived at the same date. Be contemporaries. There are many people in this room who are my contemporaries. There are others who aren't. But we're both contemporaries in another sense. So that's kind of just what happens, that occurs. Yet we nonetheless share that world. We may not belong to our time, but we're in our time together. So we have a lot to talk about. So that's not as strong, but it's fairly strong. If you occur at the same time as someone or something else, that's like adventitious, that just kind of happens, that's arbitrary. But already you see there's three different ways of being in time, and they're all quite interesting. They're not dull, they're not just things that merely happen as such. So, and then when you go further through the Oxford English Dictionary, you get to modern. And so it turns out contemporary is the way of being modern. And in fact, when you look at that, this is just applied to styles of furniture, and it's still that you go into Home Depot and you have the contemporary section and the colonial section and the American and so on and so forth. So in one sense, it's tedious, but modern is contemporary. And in art discourse throughout the world since the 60s, contemporary has in fact replaced modern as the main term, the main point of reference in our discourse, so much so that most people don't even think about it. So what I'm asking you first to do is think about how interesting it is to consider what art might be like today if it didn't just happen or wasn't just being made, but was in fact responding to the conditions of contemporaneity, the situation that we're in. I can't go into this in massive detail, and I'll spare you. But this is the sort of thing that takes my students a year to absorb, this kind of historical framework and structure that I'm laying out here. And just very briefly, what I'm trying to capture here is this... Oh, I'm sorry, I'll go back. Not an Australian shark, but we'll capture that in a minute. I'm trying to speak about three different ways in which art is in fact contemporary. And then how specific kinds of art and specific issues and ideas and concerns relate to those ways. And it's not just that these things are happening now. These things have actually occurred over over a period from, to be really precise, the late 1950s, so it is almost a 60-year period, but really since the 1980s. And during the 1980s, or beginning even the 1970s, major shifts in the dominant practices of art making occurred throughout the world. In Europe and America, modernist art came under enormous internal critique and discussion and criticism, basically in very profound ways, and shifted into a situation which many people use the term postmodernism for in architecture and in art. And you can pick out a style of postmodernist art, and you can see it in various people's work. I think that's continued in ways I'll show you in a minute, which I call sensationalist art and remodernism. That places like the Museum of Modern Art, because they can never become galleries of contemporary art without giving up the sort of cultural power that they have, continually remodernize the art that they show and art that comes anywhere near them. I'll demonstrate that for you in a minute. But that's been going on really in the North, in Europe and America. Throughout the rest of the world, following the process of decolonization in Africa, in South America, throughout the Pacific and so on and so forth, these processes continue, a kind of post-colonial constellation, turning on ideological clashes and issues. Eastern Europe, this has been going on in different sorts of ways. And these tendencies have become the things that concern artists, that artists create works around and for, say, to develop a national art. And in a very interesting way, I think, contemporary Aboriginal art is a national art for Australian Aboriginal people. And in a way, it's become an art for non-Indigenous people, such as myself. It's become, in a way, our national art as well. Not particularly because of intentions on the part of people, but because of the way in which the country fits into the world order. It's not the driver, it's not the most powerful country, it's a small and relatively middle-level dependent country. So there are ways of thinking about these things in new ways once you start to look at it on this scale. And here I speak of a movement from nationalism through internationalism, globalization and control and hegemony to cosmopolitanism, a movement towards people understanding more and more about each other, understanding much more how much more different we are from each other and how much more work we need to do to keep working and living in the same world together. And that precisely is the sort of thing that artists, young artists particularly nowadays, are very concerned with. What is it to be in a world? What is it to find place in a world, the further extents of which seem to be crazy and insane and incredibly violent? What is it to try and find location when you're always being dislocated? What is it to live in a time where people seem to have different sorts of sense of what time is? Our times are not in sync with each other. What is it to live in a world where we're mediated all the time? How do we resist that? Why does everything tend to seem so subjective? Why does everything tend to focus on me as a consumer? How can I actually act effectively against that sense, act for and with other people? Now, these are the sort of concerns of artists, and I won't go through it tonight because, as I said, it takes a whole year to lay out, and I'm trying to write a book about it at the moment. But what I will do is go on from here and try and show you how Australian Aboriginal art works in these conditions. Now, clearly, the main point I'm making is that it comes up and comes up for attention in the international world as following decolonisation, following fundamentally the fact in Australia that the policies based on the idea that Aboriginal people would eventually die out or disappear or be assimilated, those policies fail. And those policies failed precisely and mainly because Aboriginal people in Australia survived and their populations are growing. Small as they are, they're growing. So let's turn something around. And that, in effect, is a reaction to being colonised. And that's what's going on. I think it's very important for you to understand that one of the ways, one of the major ways in which this has occurred is through the practice of art, a classic form of communicating in a positive, non-violent fashion. That's what's been going on in a major way. And then I'll go on to show you indeed how many artists addressing these questions of contemporaneity. Okay, so that's quite a little bit of theory. That's the framework. Let's have a look at contemporary art that everyone would absolutely agree this is a classic, almost notorious work of contemporary art. You can go and see it currently at the Metropolitan Museum, where it's been given an entire room of its own. After you look at Clifford Still, then you can step in and see Damien Hirst's work, the title of which you see here. Australians are very fond of it because this is a shark from the waters off Queensland. The first one got a bit sick, so he actually got another one, and he sold it to Mr. Cohen for $8 million, and then Mr. Cohen paid for the new shark and had it rebuilt just last year. So it's now sitting in the... that's a very contemporary thing for an artist to do, not only sell the work, but get the person who bought it to remake it, keep on making it contemporary for you. Extraordinary business. Anyway, this work is contemporary in that Euro-American sense because it deals with the media. It's about, obviously, the movie Jaws. It's about what it is for something to hit you in the face. It's about an image that you can imagine as a mediated image. But also, and to be serious about it, because I do think it is a very important work of art in important ways, it's about immediacy as such. It's about what it is for something to come from nowhere, for something to come from out of time, to suddenly erupt into your world. It's a classic image of the traumatic occurrence, something that literally appears, as I say, perhaps from an unconscious or from out of time, out of chance. It's an absolutely shocking work of art if you give it time to work on you. And like many works by Damien Hirst, it's a metaphor for the nature of death in contemporary life, and that's really what his art is about. Even his most notorious current work, a work called For the Love of God, a skull made entirely, almost entirely of diamonds, at a cost of, I think, cost him $90 million to do it, and I think he's selling it. It cost him $9 million, and I think he's selling it for $100 million. It cost so much on the market that he himself was part of a consortium that had bought it. He is, in fact, the third richest person in England, this artist. So that's one extreme of contemporary art, and a very self-conscious one. Now, there's others. The second tendency I spoke to you about, the post-colonial constellation, which is a term my friend Oquien Wesel uses, it's really making art contemporary, but not from a Western perspective, but really from the rest of the world, making its own interests known, and particularly its own sense of what it is to live in the present, and a profoundly historical sense of what it is to live in the present. This is a work by Georges Ayagbo from Benin, this work called African Socialism. He's a man who lives in his village. He walks each day. He picks up whatever he finds from wherever he finds it. He gathers things into these amazing installations that, in fact, tell the history of socialism in his own country and in throughout Africa, which is a long and complex one. He does other works that are kind of that show you the histories of cities or regions. On village in Benin or in Nigeria. But this kind of approach to thinking about what it is to be in time and to live on the land or to in fact to be the land has clearly been happening on the Australian continent for millennia. It burst forth again in the early 70s in the Central Deserts and continues as a struggle for land rights, for social recognition, and acknowledgement of past wrongs. I'll show you the second work that people from the Sandy Desert, people from many different communities in the Sandy Desert, bought for a land rights court sitting in Fitzroy Crossing in 2003. Now, they're gathered together a bit closely for the photograph, but each of these areas, for example, this one, and then this one around here, like this, I'm sorry, this one like this, and then another one like this, this one here, they all, in fact, are the main country of particular individuals and elders who you see here. You'll be pleased to know, many of you may not know, that what you have to do to achieve recognition of your land rights is to demonstrate continuous occupation of the land. That's one of the criteria. Another one is you know, a continuing commitment to it, a deep knowledge of it, and so on and so forth. The artists, by painting this work and by making their statements, were able to convince the court in this case that they did in fact have those rights, and they were granted, very good of the court to do so. It's the only one, I think, of only two cases where they have so far. The core exchange that's going on here is perhaps nowhere better expressed than in this great work of public art, the Aboriginal Memorial, produced by about 20 and eventually 40 people from Rumangini in central Arnhem Land, right at the top of central Arnhem Land. It's a work that is on display in the National Gallery in Canberra, for those of you who haven't been there. It's the only work in the National Gallery in Canberra for which an undertaking has been given, a legally binding one, that will always be on display in a prominent space as you enter the gallery. That gives it a sort of status different from most works of art in museums, which can be shown or not shown, taken on or off. But it has that. And it's important that it does, really, because it fundamentally deserves it. It's a wonderful entranceway, a welcome to, in a sense, Aboriginal Australia, or to Australia from an Aboriginal perspective, and particularly the perspective of these people, because what it does is invite you to walk through a series of burial poles, and the burial poles are all, in fact, painted by individuals who have ownership of particular bits of country, beginning at the top of the Glyde River and working your way through down the river towards Rumangini, which is down here. So each person here, one, two, three, are painting their own areas. You can see them here from another angle. And indeed, I've got a closer image of it here. The artists are painting burial poles, so-called. These are poles that, as you know, are not grave markers, but poles that relate to part of the burial ceremony relevant to people from these particular clan groups and families, so that they're marked with the imagery that's quite specific to these people, and they're marked in a way that's absolutely specific to the individual and the family involved. As you work through, various artists, such as Paddy Wayne Burringer, in fact start to introduce elements from ceremony about death ceremony. Some imagery is also given there. So the whole thing takes you from almost as if you're walking along from the water through the sand, through the mangroves, through the basically the areas themselves, and then they transform literally into spirit worlds, worlds of the people, worlds of the ancestors and originary beings who created them. So it's a wonderfully welcoming work of art, welcomes non-Indigenous people into it and encompasses you with it. It's also, of course, a memorial to 200 years of Aboriginal people dying under the occupation of non-Indigenous people. But it's both. It's both these things at once. So an enormously subtle work of art. It happens also to be a painting and a sculpture at once. There are many other things that it is, but I won't go into them in great detail. This kind of intense engagement with what it is to be your own country, right? What it is to be your own country, is to be in time in an almost absolute way. It's to be in time and in place in a way that's very hard for many of us who come from secular cultures and live in secular cultures to imagine. But that's fundamentally what's being projected through works such as Emily Warrior's Desert Storm and many, many works of Aboriginal art. This being in your place, in the time that's absolutely appropriate to that place. We see it in Turki Tolson, Tjuparula's great series he painted up until his death in the late 2000. Large paintings, small paintings, paintings of the story of the straightening of the spears. At a certain part of the central desert, where one of the first groups of men who ever gathered together as a group became aware that there was another group further to the north. And this group, there was a possibility of a war, of some kind of threatening behaviour going on. So the elders instructed the younger people in making spears. And straightening spears is to take, obviously, a branch of some kind and then slowly heat it and knead it till it dries and then straightens. The great joy and point of this story is that on both sides, the elders took so long to do it that they never got around to fighting. Okay, and this is, you know, it's an absolutely core ethical story about the origins of war, because at the origins of war is the origins of the possibility of peace as well. And that was his particular focus in his work. And all these very tiny dots, the colours clearly evoke both the sun, the earth, the body of people, fire, ash, and all these elements are there. And they're evoked literally just by dots that are lined up. The spears are hinted at in some of these shapes here. But in, as you see here, but in a certain sense, every one of these lines can be a spear as well. It's a sort of mesmeric evocation of this great, great moral story. So that's a certain set of ways of being in time and being in a kind of eternal time. You know, the possibility of moving from the absolutely contemporary to the eternal in a blink, in a flick like that. That's possible. It's a contemporary experience. That's possible. Now I want to shift to artists who live in the cities or the country towns. They've also given us another kind of deeply moving, imagined imagery of these developments. The case of Tracy Moffat, who I mentioned before, her photographic series Something More from 1989, where she plays herself in a kind of South Pacific setting, a sort of setting that's both cinematic but also staged, and also like a painting. She stages the story of a young woman from a family, a very violent country-based family. The girl leaves, runs away on her bike. She's found dead by the side of the road. It's very dramatic, as if it's a series of stills for a film, to advertise a film. And as she went on, she really developed extremely subtle ways of evoking, again, this sort of traumatic register of what it is to be in a racial minority and to live in the countryside of a place like Australia, which for all its great beauties has extraordinary violences built into its culture, which is one of the reasons why saying sorry is so important for a government to do, because governments can be a source of systemic violence when they don't do that. So Up in the Sky is the series I'm showing here, and it's a brilliant series of images of life, harshness of life in the bush. This is two young men fighting towards the end of it. And just to show you how subtle and erudite she is, it's actually a reference to the last scene of a movie by Pasolini called Acatone or the Pimp, which was shown, made in the 1960s and shown to those of us old enough to remember Italian realist cinema at a very early age. Tracy Moffat is much younger, but she's very, she looks at the whole history of cinema and photography all the time, no matter where it comes from. She built it into her work. A more historical perspective is obvious in the work of artists such as Gordon Bennett. This is an untitled work of his. In fact, it's based on a kind of conceptual art premise. As you see, it reads, it shows you imagery from children's textbooks about, the colonisation of Australia. The Aboriginal people see some ships coming in. The word dismay is written underneath. They see the British flag raised. The word displace occurs. They see themselves subject to massacre. The word disperse is there. They see themselves in an enslaved situation, dispirit. They gather in Sydney and become drunks. This is a work by Augustus Earle, quoted here. That's called display, putting on a public display. The upshot of it is shown against a totally black square, as if it's a work by the Russian artist Kazimir Malevich, is the word dismiss. So that's a kind of very summary history of the treatment of Aboriginal people in the years leading up to the so-called bicentennial of 1988. So he clearly has a much less redemptive and positive view than did the artist from Rumyngini, who I spoke about before. Now similarly, he talks about how the use of language, words such as abo, bong, coon, etc., etc., how they actually, it's the idea of sticks and stones will break my bones, but words will never hurt me. Well, of course words hurt me. Words hurt more than anything else in many ways, and particularly if they're built into the language. So this is called History Painting, Excuse My Language, 1992. The famous work of his, which I was glad to be able to put on the cover, the back cover matching a work by Arthur Boyd of the edition of Australian Painting that I did with Bernard Smith, literally in 1990. As soon as this painting came out, I saw it in Brisbane and realised I had to have it on a book that would be in every school in Australia. This is called The Nine Ricochets, Fall Down Black Fella, Jump Up White Fella, and it's an image again from the school book about massacres. Massacres of Aboriginal camps carried out, in fact, under duress, presumably by Aboriginal people often. That's part of the story implied here. And then he's quoting a section of a work by an immigrant Latvian artist, an Australian artist called Imants Tillers. And we're in the period of appropriation, of postmodern appropriation, where artists don't originate imagery, but take it from other artists' work and put different kinds of quotations together to make their point. So it's called the montage, you know, step one, step two, to imply step three. And so he's implying that there's some connection between the fantasy stories that white Australians might have felt, even in this case it's a reference right back to a Latvian children's story. So he's an immigrant, a white immigrant to Australia, an Aboriginal indigenous person being treated as if he or she is basically equally alien within their own country. So that's what this work is about by implication, and indeed it is about that. That's to say Gordon Bennett, was reacting to this work by Imants Tillers called The Nine Shots of 1985, 5 years earlier, where Imants appropriated images from a German artist, George Baselitz, and then from a painting by Michael Nelson Jacamara. Just took them and mixed them together to make a point about being a provincial in Australia, a provincial artist who's subject to the influence of European art, and Baselitz was the most famous European artist at that time, but also being subject to the influence of indigenous art from Australia, caught in the middle between the two of them, is where the Australian artist is. And that's really what he was wanting to tell us about in that picture. But Gordon Bennett felt that this was an appropriation of the art of his own people. So he, in the painting I showed you a moment ago, reacted against that and showed how violent these appropriations can be, even though they're symbolic ones. Now, Gordon's become one of the artists who can tackle these sort of issues on a global scale. And I'll just show you one example of that. This is his reaction to 9/11, or one of his paintings reacting to 9/11. At that point in this series, Notes to Basquiat, he was communicating with a very famous artist from the East Village, Michel Basquiat, who did work based on graffiti, and did work in the manner of these skull-type shapes, and wrote often on the walls. In fact, but Gordon Bennett has shifted this into, instead of graffiti, it's modern, contemporary, current, you see, so modernity. Artists are very concerned with these definitions that I showed you before, and indeed include them in their works. This is a picture that goes back and repaints the ones you've just seen. These figures, these artists, poet figures who have been standing around, these butchered people or people who are obliged to do the butchering. They're gathering here in 2001 after the bombing of the World Trade Center, the planes flying into the World Trade Center, with the image of Allah appearing there. This horrible business of the bomb and the plane turning into a bomb and so on. This references back to an earlier work, one of Gordon Bennett's very first paintings, The Coming of the Light. He's being ironic about enlightenment, the bringing of European enlightenment to Australia. That's clearly not happening. It's a very bright scene. September the 11th, 2001 was a very bright morning, as you see here, but darkness is very much occurring. Now, in that sense, he's doing something that artists all over the world were doing, but in fact, he's doing something that Turki Tolson Çukurova may have anticipated, because just before he died, in this print called Two Sites, which in one sense is an image of two places of importance to him, I must admit I could not but see this as an image of the towers. So what does that tell us about temporality and spirituality? Well, these are questions many contemporary artists are taking them up, and I'll just give you one example. Paul Chan, an American artist, in a series of projections on the floor that he did over quite a period, 2005 to 2007, this is just one of his, it's a kind of projected animation which gradually shows all these things slowly rising up through a space. Eventually they become people rising through a space, they become aeroplanes rising through a space, objects of all sorts rise through a space, and there you see the people going up through this space until they disappear into the sky. So it's a reversal of the people having to jump out of the towers, the World Trade Center towers, and it's very much also thinking about this idea of rapture, where people are suddenly taken up to heaven. And he's basically saying there's some weird, strange connection between the two of them, which is fairly horrifying. So it's a very American take on this kind of issue. Okay, now, finally, just one last couple of points, if I may, Margot, is that okay? I hope I've demonstrated to you that contemporary Aboriginal artists are contemporary in fairly profound ways in their work. But there's a bit of a discussion going on between art historians in Australia, Ian McLean and myself, for example. Is this really modern or is it contemporary? And it's probably a question many of you have on your mind. I mean, what's the big difference here? So let's, if you can spare me about 15 minutes, we'll go through that and sort of wrap this up, because that difference between the modern and the contemporary, and the idea of moving from the modern to the contemporary, is a crucial debate that's occurring in art worlds all over the world. And this gives me a chance to ask it in the context of Aboriginal art. So Ian McLean, who's a wonderful writer, everything he writes I urge you to read, has argued that Aboriginal art in Australia has made continuous adjustments and accommodations to European or settler-imposed modernity and is therefore a modernism. Not contemporary, it's a modernism. Now, certainly Aboriginal adjustment can be considered as one amongst many of those that are thought about as multiple modernities. Now, one of the great revisions going on in the history of modern art around the world is to shift it from being a story of what happened in Paris and then what happened in New York after the Second World War to being a story of all the multiple modernities that all the multiple modernisms, all the cosmopolitan connected modernisms that artists in different centres all over the world created in ways that were specific to those centres and how those places and those countries modernised, okay? Which didn't happen all in one big thing and didn't happen just in the north and not in the south. It happened in very ways that are very specific to that. Now, as it turns out, if you really look closely at those developments, indigenous art was very rarely called modern because particularly it was not called modern in the north and very rarely in the local art languages in each region. Probably because Euro-Americans could not conceive indigenous peoples as modern, except perhaps in a sense that if they did become modern, it would be somehow to their detriment. That's to put it politely. Mostly people just thought that, as I said before, they were just surviving from some past or other. Indeed, in art market sales, in book titles, the output of art from Africa, Oceania and Australia during the 20th century, right up until the 1980s, in fact, was divided into traditional and contemporary. In other words, indigenous artists could be traditional artists or they could be contemporary artists. They couldn't actually be modern. So this has led Ian to argue that when Australian contemporary Aboriginal art was called contemporary art, which it was regularly from the 1980s onwards by people like me, then it was the first contemporary art in the world anywhere, he argues. Okay, so he's argued both things, that Australian Aboriginal art has been modern, it's our Australia's real modernism, and he's now argued more recently that it's the first contemporary art. But in fact, as it happens, Uli Bayer and other people labelled African art, I would actually say modern African art, contemporary from the 1960s onwards. Now, all this might sound to you like a, art historians just worrying about what to call something. And indeed, if you, it is the case that Rex Batterby wrote a book about modern Australian Aboriginal art in 1951, published it in 1951. Very few other people have used the word modern in relation to it, except Hank Eaves did it recently, mainly for an exhibition in Washington a few years ago. I think because the word contemporary was in every other book title, so he just shoved in modern. There's not a lot of thinking, deep thinking about the terms in either case. They really just meant the stuff that was happening now. So if we look at this, the word modern, just quickly, we'll do a run through of the word modern. It's very different from contemporary. Initially it meant of today, or just what's happening now. It meant now existing. Now that meaning is very obsolete nowadays. Relating to present times as distinguished from the past, for example, the Middle Ages and modern history. That's the dominant, absolutely dominant meaning of the term. In other words, the modern has become historical. It's about this period compared to the previous period. The question facing us now is, have we moved, in fact, from this modern period they're talking about here in the dictionary to the contemporary, another shift? Or it can be a movement in art and architecture and so on. So they're the standard ways of thinking about modern. And what I've done, again, I won't go through it in detail, but if you connect the whole history of from body painting to neoclassicism, that's a long time. If you look at modernity, the period, the condition of modernity, it did produce modern art, realisms, modernisms, avant-garde art. There was this main art. The postmodern moment in the 70s and 80s, I think, produced these tendencies. our conditions produce a kind of contemporary art of the sort I've been showing you, indeed of this sort. So to me, the thing moves along like that. Now, how does this relate to the question of the modern or not? If you, in terms of contemporary Aboriginal art, a work such as this by Johnny Morrindal, Mardian painting of 2001. Now, he's an artist who's moved from very specific, almost, I would say, realist accounts of crucial dreaming stories, in the manner of his predecessor, Irrawaddy, who one, I think, could regard indeed as a great modern artist. Picasso did so, for example. Has moved to a point where he's showing us these major ceremonies, the major ceremonial grounds, regions, without any specifics and details of them, but evoking them as a kind of intense spiritual presence, a sort of rock that many, many artists are now moving towards. Not abstract painting as such, but a kind of art that tries to capture spiritual presence, make it manifest through the means of painting, mostly. And to me, that's why he's moved in this direction, creating these very large bark paintings, beautifully, finely generated, such that the rock, the effect, is the spiritual presence of them, and it makes the spiritual presence present to the viewer. So in that sense, it's absolutely contemporary with the viewers looking. That's what he's trying to bring about. So maybe that's the shift that's occurring here. And in a case such as this, Rosella Namok, whose work is in the exhibition you could see here at the Kluge, not this particular work, but one very close to it. Here's an artist who is looking at trying to paint a moment before time, proper strong. In other words, she's actually trying to create what Christians would call a Genesis moment, you know, the moment of Genesis as the world beginning to try to happen, to come into being in some sense. So the origins of time. I mean, it's a very big topic for a young artist to tackle, but she's certainly doing it. If we just applied an art historical comparison to this work, we might look at this work by Gerhard Richter, very famous, outstanding abstract painter from Germany, again a postmodern painter, who does works based on photography and then shifts the register of them. And this is a photograph of the funeral of one of the members of the Bader-Meinhof gang, a very famous image in German consciousness of the disruptions of German society during the 70s. He painted it, as you see, 11 years later. And then he deliberately blurred the photograph with his paint, because this is about historical memory, about not remembering exactly, about the way media works on your memory as a social being. So that's very concentrated about just a few years. But in a certain sense, there are connections here. So it makes sense for Rosalie Namok to be attracted to the idea of blurring, putting up something that's very hard to paint and doing it by suggestion and by blurring. So I think we're looking at parallels and coincidences. One artist is picking up something from the style of another, but for using it for purposes that she already has beforehand. She's not doing it just to create works that look like Gerhard Richter's works. Okay, the final thing I want to say is, why do we worry about this? What's at stake at this question of being in time in relation to contemporary Aboriginal art? Well, to me it's about whether we've moved from the situation of colonisation or not in Australia. And hopefully we are moving. But if so, it's going to be something like this. If it's going to work, it's going to work somewhere like this. The process at the core of colonisation, indeed everywhere in the world, is that the colonisers regard the colonised, particularly if they're indigenous peoples, as survivors from an earlier era. They regard them as anachronisms, as non-contemporaneous contemporaries. So wrap your head around non-contemporaneous contemporaries. This is a term that sounds heavy duty, but it's very important. Non-contemporaneous contemporaries. That means time itself will inevitably erase them. So why not speed it up a little bit and subject them to a bit of temporal cleansing? And that's in fact what happened in the assimilation stolen generation period in Australia. That was about temporal cleansing. It was about taking people into our time, not letting them have their time, which was a different time, and not letting them have their time at the same time as we had our time. Okay? Now, against this, Indigenous peoples don't have too many choices. But Indigenous peoples clearly want to outlive modernity. And I, you know, my knowledge of the Indigenous people I know makes me believe that they will in fact do that. Not everybody, but many Indigenous people will outlive modernity. Now, one way of doing it is by becoming contemporary, while at the same time maintaining traditional values that are regarded as indispensable. Values important to people for whom the world is not only secular but also spiritual. If you're in only secular time, you're not open to the movement of spiritual time, which is different. If you're open to the connections between them, then you produce works of art like these. Now, how do you do this under conditions of relative powerlessness? It's not enough to simply demand the right to do so, nor to work out how to live a divided life. It becomes necessary to try and change the terms of the equation, to persuade the more powerful peoples to try and reimagine their world as a world in which people who live differently are also genuine contemporaries. That's to say, they belong to the same time as you do, even if you belong differently to that time. This was Turki Tolson's fundamental message I was trying to bring out to you before. And this is what's at stake in the debates that I'm, such as the question I'm raising today. So if it sounds as if worrying about whether Aboriginal art is traditional or modern or contemporary, if it sounds like haggling over words, or it sounds like a debate amongst art critics, well, maybe it is, but I'm trying to persuade you there's much more to it than that. If we think about it on a very large global scale for a moment, my sense is that there is indeed a shift going on towards a much wider recognition of multeity. Here's another word, M-U-L-T-E-I-T-Y. It's in the dictionary, I didn't make it up. It means the simultaneity of difference, not the simultaneity of same, the things that are the same. Right? Now, there's a wider recognition that that's how the world is now, and that increasing diversity is a good thing in itself. As distinct from the relentless progress towards secular humanism that drove the modernity project and the spread of market-dominated homogeneity that is sought under globalization. So against that, this multiplicity of ways of being in time, I think is a set of values that we're moving towards. We have to move towards, and we are in fact doing it. In fact, it's a shift of our marker from the modern to the contemporary. So I'll finish with this last work by Rosie Nummel, which is like a work that's in the exhibition, except she did it on surfboards. It's about old girls, they talk in the sand, they yarn for country, land and country. If you're from Queensland and Scott Redford and there's all that sand there, doing them on surfboards is, well, it's contemporary. But it's also it's also taking us back in time, and it's making that spiritual time alive and present to us as well. So I'll conclude. I submit to you that contemporary Aboriginal art is contemporary, not merely in the weak sense that it is the art that Aboriginal people happen to be making today, in the circumstances in which they happen to find themselves. It's not just that, but in a much stronger sense. And it's obvious when you look at the art that's put in front of you without prejudice. If you do, you'll see that the apparently most non-contemporaneous peoples still surviving in the world today, right, Australian Aboriginal people, the most non-contemporaneous, still surviving in the world today, have not only come up with a number of ways of revealing to the rest of us the deeper dimensions of the contemporaneity that we all confront, so they're showing us more about this than many other artists are, but they're also pointing us to some of the ways in which we might live together within these complex currents. And many of them are doing so not by imitating the styles and practices of contemporary arts from the artists from the dominant cultures, but on their own terms, terms we are invited to learn to understand. The fact that they're doing so is of the essence of the whole project. We are being invited to learn to understand these different ways of being in time now. I thank you for sharing with me tonight my efforts to learn something from these artists. Thank you. So I'm happy to take questions or hear comments if anyone wishes to offer them. Sorry? Yarn for Country? That's in fact the title that's given to this work. Yarn in the sense of American word, is that what you're responding to? Instead of Talk for Country? That's in fact in the title. That's her title. So. Yarn, the Americanism spread all over the world, you know. They're not necessarily a bad thing. But absolutely, to me, not in a general sense, but in quite a specific one that makes sense for individuals depending on where they're at and the knowledge that they have, yeah. So I'm definitely not making a plea for this is great art because it's more spiritual than the chair or something, as general as that. It's quite specific the ways where speaking about it. I'm just at the moment reading a book by Charles Taylor. I'm not sure, does that, his name ring a bell to people? Charles Taylor is a Canadian philosopher who's just written a book called A Secular Age, and it's a struggle to read, but nonetheless, because it's almost as long as the Bible, and probably probably covers about as much as in about 2 pages of the Bible, but nonetheless, it's very, I'm kind of wrestling with it because what he's trying to describe is the change from the medieval to the modern era, from what it was like for people to live in a world in which a world literally, the world of presence of spirits and various sorts of gods and so on, and forces that were explainable in that manner was just unquestioned. But what slowly emerged is the possibility of what he calls exclusive secular humanism. In other words, the idea that you can live through your life and live in the world without in assuming that the more complex connections and things that operate in the world can be erased. They'll just be erased eventually, along with the people, who are producing them. So it's very challenging. The main point I'm making on that issue is not that these artists are saying, let's all become spiritual. The main point I'm making is that there are many different ways of being in time in the world now, and it's crucial to learn about and respect them, not all equally, because they're not equal. Some of them are vicious and horrible, right? But to be alert to the fact that we're moving more and more into a circumstance where the set of values we might have been brought up with are not going to become universal. And that applies to Osama bin Laden as much as it does to the leaders of the great political parties in this country, I think. Anyway, right. Turn me on, I go on forever. George is frowning. Does he have a question? No? No? Okay. All right. Thank you.